I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. We call it an American conversation with global attitude. This one is about American pop culture. It's an export industry if you're speaking of Hollywood and hip-hop music. But I mean generally the version of ourselves that goes out with our songs and our poetry, the imagery of our sitcoms and our sports. We're extending a thread here on American exceptionalism. What's peculiar about us? In conversation with the free-spirited freelance Martha Bayless. Martha is a very careful consumer of movies and TV, jazz and pop. She was just back when we spoke from a tour that included India and China, Indonesia and Egypt to see and hear the way America presents itself to the world in what is now a night and day global enterprise called American entertainment. Martha Bayless, you're a prominent player in a book that fascinates me, Understanding America, The Anatomy of an Exceptional Nation. What makes us different if we are is fascinating, and culture seems a great place to begin. It is the most acceptable form, in a way, of American domination. And it's a region that we're proud of when we think of the Voice of America jazz broadcasts or Louis Armstrong as Ambassador Satch. I always used to tell my kids the reason they called the 20th century the American century was, one, we got into the victory on World War II in a very timely, late, important fashion. And second, we had the Basie Band. We had 4/4 rhythm in the most compelling, beautiful sort of perfection that underlay this African-American rhythm that rules the world. That may have been sort of my golden starting point, but where do we find ourselves in the 21st century in the export of this phenomenal cultural energy of our peculiar country?
Well, when people think about perceptions of American culture overseas, if they have any historical memory, a lot of people think about the Cold War. And they think about a wonderful man named Willis Conover, who started and ran for many, many years, until the 90s when he died, with a program called Music USA on Voice of America that was broadcast into Eastern Europe and Soviet Union and eventually to a lot of other places in the world. For most of its history, he played mostly jazz. He talked about jazz. It wasn't just the music. It was also Willis Conover's way of dealing with it, which was very down-to-earth, very accessible. He wasn't snooty about it. He wasn't too hip. He had just the right mixture of approachability and knowledge. And that in itself was an aspect of American culture that people found very appealing. The fact that some guy would go on the radio and play very sophisticated music without being snobbish about it, without talking down to his audience, but sort of, you know, bringing them along, educating them, telling them what they needed to know. That's that sort of democratic approach to culture. And it was used with high culture, too. I mean, not that jazz isn't high culture. It was used for other forms of American culture that are seen as more elite than jazz or were at the time. Here's another example. The United States Information Agency, which was founded in 1953, it grew out of the old wartime information service, which was basically a kind of mixture of propaganda and just information about the U.S. around the world. USIA opened or expanded a huge number of libraries and cultural centers in Europe, but also in a lot of other places. The Frankfurt America House Library had, I think at its peak, it had 45,000 volumes in there. And it wasn't just that they had libraries, they had American libraries. The distinctive thing about American libraries, open stack, circulating library, you could walk around, find a book, take it off the shelf, read it there, or take it home. They didn't have libraries like that in Europe until the USIA brought them in. This was a huge thing in Germany. Immediately, Berlin and Frankfurt changed their public libraries over to this system. And again, it said something about the United States. It said that the average Joe can walk into this imposing-looking building, walk right up to the books, pull it off the shelf, and read it. In the past in Europe, you had to ask the librarian. You had to present your credentials. You had to wait until the book could be retrieved. Mm-hmm. And even then, you might be allowed to look at it there if you were the right sort of person. But this was intensely democratic. It was, you know, that old American idea that the average person has a right to educate himself to the best of his abilities. So that was a huge success. We did lots of things like that. The USIA, all of the people who worked for the USIA, they were sort of a maverick bunch. There are a lot of journalists, academics, of a hip variety. Mm. And they were colorful people. A lot of them were very expert in the languages of the regions that they were in. And they kind of knew what to do. So they cobbled together these cultural programs. Oftentimes under conditions of real restriction where people had no other information about the United States. So it was really, I mean, they had some disasters, but it was a very interesting effort that went on for many years.
And both the message and the medium said freedom. Freedom was the word.
Well, yeah, it said free. I mean, freedom, I have a whole chapter in my book on freedom, which is called Projections of Freedom. And I quote from Chris Christopherson's Immortal Lines, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing ain't worth nothing, but it's free. I think what we project now through a lot of our entertainment is freedom in the sense of libertinism. It's freedom in the sense of I can do whatever I want and screw you. I've had people overseas actually say to me that that's what they think American freedom means. Mm. That it's the freedom of the sovereign kind of self kind of freedom. You know, Orlando Patterson uses that term, the sovereignal freedom. It's the freedom of the master over the slave in his historical account. Mm. But it's not a very pretty side of freedom. And we project this kind of freedom to do whatever the hell you want, unfettered by connections with other people, unfettered by ties to, you know, family or community or any kind of ethical or moral restrictions. It's a very radical idea of freedom, just as the will of the individual, basically to satisfy his or her desires. Now, I'm not saying that's what freedom means to Americans. It isn't. But it's what we project.
Take it apart, Martha. Cite an example, including movies or music or, dare we say, books, ideas. What is American culture in the world today?
Well, the one thing you didn't say, which is I think the dominant thing, is television. The dominant American cultural presence in a lot of the world today is television, either American movies on satellite television, which is reaching millions of people, billions of people around the world, American TV shows, which have long penetrated lots of parts of the world, or, you know, pirated material, pirated TV shows, pirated films, which is huge around the world, needless to say. So television is a really dominant medium in lots of places, much more than popular music. India, China, the Arab world. I'm focusing on these parts of the world because I took a trip last year around the world to six different countries interviewing people. Mm. And my focus is, in the book that I'm currently writing, on those areas because they're either predominantly Muslim or they are of great strategic importance, namely China. I spent some time in China. I spent some time in India. The other places I went to were in the Middle East, Turkey, and Indonesia. And I spoke to and interviewed a whole bunch of people. And I learned some things, which I'm now telling you. One of them is that one of the most popular forms of American entertainment around the world, which isn't really copied by others, but is adopted wholesale, the American version of it, are what I call urban singles comedies or urban singles TV shows. Friends is one of the most popular TV shows in the entire world. Mm. Sex and the City is hugely popular. These shows are enormously popular. And I didn't know that until I went on my trip. And people started talking to me about it. Young people started talking to me about Friends and Sex and the City. And what I learned was, in a lot of societies, the thing that is as appealing as anything about these shows, it's not always, I mean, to some degree, it's the clothes, the apartments, the lifestyle, which is affluent beyond the dreams of a lot of young people who watch these things. And it's not always the sex, although the sex is very important, particularly in Sex and the City, but also in Friends, what these things are saying about sexuality. But it's the personal freedom that these young people have. Mm-hmm. We Americans tend to think, you know, you get out of college. Well, first you go to college. There's no rules. You have 4 years. You can basically do what you want. Even at conservative schools, you can binge drink, you can hook up, you can basically party and do whatever you want. And nobody's watching you. No adults are watching you. We also assume that when you get out of college, you might get an apartment and live on your own and, you know, have lovers and of different sexes, ages and colors and kind of work your way through your issues. And we also assume that eventually you're probably going to find your mate and settle down in some way or other and become more of a conventional person like your parents, assuming your parents were conventional. Well, this is uniquely American. Mm-hmm. Young people in Cairo, for example, have to live with their parents because there's no housing. And in university, they don't have any personal freedom. They don't have any chance to go and live on their own. They can't afford it. And their social mores would not permit it. And in India, where some people are more affluent, they still would not permit it because the families are so strong in India and the sense of tradition is so strong. MTV did a survey of its viewership, and the majority of them were in favor of parentally arranged marriages, meaning the parents produce a group of guys and you pick the one you like. It doesn't mean forced marriage. It's, you know, it's sort of marriages arranged by the family with the consent of the young people. So they have a whole different sexual code, a whole different sense of family and what their duties and responsibilities are. And they find this image of American freedom, you know, just living in New York with friends and no family. Do the young women in Sex and the City have families? I think there's like two references in the whole series to a family member, and it's very negative. This is completely strange to these foreign viewers. They admire the freedom. They kind of yearn after that degree of freedom. But what I find is you talk about it for a while with them, there's a kind of a recoil where they eventually end up saying things like, and I heard this dozens of times on my trip, well, that kind of freedom is okay for Americans, but we could never live that way because we're too tied to our families. Our traditions are too strong. We actually have values. Hmm. So we couldn't really live that way. That's okay for Americans. And underlying that is an assumption that Americans don't have families, that Americans don't have any particular ties to other people, that Americans, you know, conduct their personal life as a, you know, serial monogamy or serial polygamy, however you want to cut it, and that they don't ever suffer any consequences from it because basically they have lots of money and they can do what they want. In the end, I think this is not a very attractive picture to people. It attracts younger people that when they get a little more mature, they start to question it and they start to think, wow, American society must be kind of inhuman in some ways. Mm-hmm. And I'm giving you the accumulated response that I got from lots and lots of people I talked to. My question is, where do they get their idea of American ideas and customs? Because most people have not been to the United States. Mm-hmm. And there's a real pattern. People who have been to the United States are often astonished by what they find here. Namely, we're not like we appear in the movies. We're not like we appear on TV. We have our excesses and we have our laxities, but we're not what they thought. The voice of American popular culture, which is really my focus, has changed a lot in the last 30 years. And for a while, that change was very effective in terms of reaching foreign audiences. I'm thinking of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union at the latter decades of the Cold War, when the sort of 60s counterculture and its aftermath worked very well. It appealed to dissidents. It appealed to youth. The playwright and president of the Czech Republic to be, Václav Havel, was a great fan of Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. And, you know, all the real kind of hard-edge counterculture stuff, which has long since supplanted jazz as the voice of, you know, the dominant voice of American culture, certainly in music, played well in that part of the world at that time. The question that I have is, how well does that voice play in other parts of the world? And you could look back at the 70s and 80s and 90s and ask how well those voices played in the Arab world or in the Muslim world or in places like India or in places like China. And there it gets a whole lot more complicated. Duke Ellington was sent as a kind of artistic ambassador on a tour of the so-called northern tier countries, the countries they were trying to get into the Baghdad Pact. This is a lot of geopolitics that I don't understand, but he did very well in some places. He did not do so well in other places. He was not a big hit in Pakistan, for example. Mm. And he wasn't a particularly big hit in India. And Tom Simon, and in fact, Penny Farnesian's book about the jazz tours talks about this a little bit, but Tom Simon's talks about it more. You know, there are places on Earth where even jazz does not galvanize people with a love for American and an understanding of American freedoms and American culture. So I think, you know, it's very easy to talk about that wonderful time, and that was really my starting point. And having written a lot about American music, I went along for a long time on the assumption that American music was somehow this elixir that was, you know, irresistible to the rest of the world. I have since changed my view. And I also think that American music isn't what it used to be. But you know I think that.
So. When you think of that American voice in the world today, of 2008, what is it? How unique is it? We got to get to the broader question of what does it mean to export American culture in a globalizing world? But start with what it is today.
Mm-hmm. Two things are really dominant. Television shows in lots of permutations, and I can break that down for you. The other thing that is, of course, dominant are Hollywood movies. But there's only a certain kind of movie that is really dominant, that's really pulling the train, and those are the special effects blockbusters. Spider-Man, the Pirates of the Caribbean, yep. The Harry Potter series, and all those gigantic blockbuster things, which no other film industry in the world can even come close to producing. And they make so much money for Hollywood, two times as much overseas as they do here. And the revenues that they make support the entire film industry right now. Without those blockbusters, there would be no Hollywood today. Mm. And they're what people think of when they think of American movies. They don't think about these little gems, portraits of American life, which occasionally come out, which make me feel good about Hollywood. They think about, you know, the latest Pirates of the Caribbean or Spider-Man.
What is American culture? Are the Harry Potter movies, you know, made by a lot of British talent about a British boy and a book series written by a British author, does that count as American culture these days?
Well, that's, you know, anybody's judgment call. I would say Harry Potter, because it's a huge special effects blockbuster, is seen as a Hollywood movie. Without Hollywood money, it wouldn't exist.
Don't you really mean to say that without those Harry Potter movies and the foreign revenues, Hollywood wouldn't exist?
Well, a lot of these Hollywood blockbusters are international co-productions. You know, the Lord of the Fellowship of the Ring was produced largely in New Zealand, or entirely in New Zealand, using American talent and talent from other countries as well, English-speaking countries. Hollywood is globalized in the sense that it takes its production to lots of places. But it dominates in terms of its money, and it dominates in terms of where the profits flow to. And other countries have sort of made their peace with that. You know, they'd rather have Hollywood come in and do a massive international co-production than have Hollywood just shut out their movies entirely and not have their people employed. This is an old story. This goes back really as far as World War I, this agreement between Washington and Hollywood that they would scratch each other's back. You know, Washington would help Hollywood open up foreign markets, sometimes through very strong arm tactics, which have been used over the years. And Hollywood would, in the old days, make films that projected a positive image of the United States. Now, my argument about this is that the days of projecting a positive image of the United States seem to be gone. Not just blockbusters, but a lot of action films, a lot of other films take a highly conspiratorial view of how the United States works and what its role is in the world, and which we Americans find very entertaining, and people overseas find entertaining, but they also conclude that it's true. And there are very few, actually very few Hollywood films that I think depict America's role in the world in any kind of an objective or measured way. And I'm not talking about Michael Moore. You know, I'm talking about all the action films where the bad guys tend to be highly placed Washington officials and the usual oil magnates and, you know, the usual powerful Americans who are behind the scenes pulling strings. Now, we have a fair amount of that going on in this country. I wouldn't deny it. But it's not quite as starkly conspiratorial as it gets presented.
And which movies do you think about?
I would mention as one example, a recent example of a blockbuster film that to me starts to take things in a very disturbing direction. And that's this action film called 300 that came out about a year and a half ago, I'm just guessing. It's based on a comic book series, and it's about the Battle of Thermopylae between the Persians, the vast Persian army, and those few Spartans, you know, who of course held the gates, held the fortress, or not the fortress, but the pass in the mountains. It's got nothing to do with the classical story of this. It's got nothing to do with Greek or Persian history. What it is this grotesque comic book version of a few very American-looking guys holding off a massive crowd of Persians, millions of Persians, who are, for some reason, known only to the creators of this comic book and this film, depicted as grotesque kind of subhuman monsters led by a race of kind of highly perverse and grotesque, highly pierced, bizarre-looking sort of freaks. Mm. And it's sort of an army of orcs led by an officer corps of freaks. Mm. And none of them have any resemblance at all to the Persian soldiers of the period. And maybe there's a faint kind of Greek quality to the guys who are, you know, the good guys, the Greeks. But mostly they're just a bunch of really buff guys with really good weapons who can kill lots and lots of these subhumans at a time. Now, this movie is visually, they say it's visually wonderful. I think it's a few frames are interesting to look at. It gets real monotonous for me after a while. It's intensely bloody, intensely violent. And it's one of the few things in the last, I'd say, 10 years or 20 years that has united the Iranian people with their government. Mm. The film has not been shown in Iran, but as I say, people get pirated versions of things. They download it off the internet. It's, you know, lots of people in Iran have seen it. And the government denounced this film because of its depiction of Persians as, you know, grotesque monsters. And actually, the Iranians seem to the extent that we're able to judge their opinion, they agree with the government on this. They don't agree with their government about a whole lot these days, especially American culture, which they tend generally to like. Now, what possesses Hollywood to produce something like this at a high point of tension between the U.S. and Iran? I do not know. And I don't know what the solution is, because I don't advocate government censorship of Hollywood movies. But I would advocate a little awareness of the outside world on the part of people in Hollywood. And I think that is extremely low. There are individuals, I think, who understand the impact of some American films around the world is not a positive one. Mm. But a lot of people in Hollywood, I think, are kidding themselves that the impact is positive and that they're just making money hand over fist and everything's wonderful just like it always has been. And I think they're in for kind of a shock at some point.
How do you explain this kind of endlessly growing revenue and business of exporting American culture, so-called?
Mm. I mean, you're asking me sort of how do I explain the appeal of it?
Well, or just maybe the marketing, the you know, the growth charts.
Mm. Well, if we stay with Hollywood movies, Hollywood, you know, American companies dominate global distribution. It's extremely difficult for any other national film industry to get into that distribution system or get their films distributed by it unless they get picked up at a film festival, and then they will get some distribution through American channels. But long ago, Hollywood figured out the distribution was the key, and they really have a lock on it. And they also have an infinite number of other advantages. The size of the size and affluence of the domestic market has always made Hollywood a giant. I mean, if you can produce, and there's a positive spin you can put all this too. I'm not, so anti-Hollywood. One of the positive spins, which goes back to the history of American culture, is that Hollywood has always had to appeal to a large and extremely diverse population. And this comes out of more historical, older kinds of popular culture in America. I could talk a little bit about vaudeville, and the sort of the blending of different nationalities and the blending of races and of the blending of outlooks that was at the very root of American popular culture. And that, I would say, is something truly exceptional. And it's been a great source of strength in American popular culture. I should point out at this point that I've generally been a fan and a defender of popular culture, even though I sound a bit like the church lady right now denouncing it. As a fan, I'm also a critic. In terms of the degree of self-restraint, self-censorship that used to be exerted by the American entertainment industry, we are way past the goalpost. I mean, we are out there with really no controls and no self-controls. And that is unprecedented in our history. We didn't used to produce entertainment on a mass scale that was completely without restraint in terms of violence, in terms of depictions of sexuality, in terms of depictions of criminality. We didn't used to produce it to that scale with no restraint. We're doing that now. And the other thing that's happening now is we're exporting it more than we ever did. Mm. The Bureau of Economic Analysis came out with a recent report saying that between 1986 and 2005, the sales of services to foreign persons by the motion picture and video industries went from about $2 billion to about $11 billion, which is an increase of about 500%. Mm-hmm. So and that's just a legal export. I'm not talking about piracy, mm-hmm. which is huge. So it's on number one, it's without any of the traditional restraints. And number two, it's going further and to more places in the world than it ever did before, into little villages in Pakistan, into the remote regions of China, into very conservative religious and social settings. And it's depicting America to people. That's really my concern.
Come back to the general question about American exceptionalism. To me, this exceptionalism question, it comes out of de Tocqueville. But the question about exceptionalism is at two levels. One, can we escape the fate of empires, the Brits or the Romans or all the others that rise and fall? Mm-hmm. Are we here forever on the top? And the cultural question really is, are we just peculiarly and forever interesting to the rest of the world in ways that other cultures aren't?
Well, I think one thing that is clearly exceptional about the United States, as opposed to, say, the other empires of history, is the fact that it is pluralist at its source. And I don't, there were different Greek islands, but there were different parts of Rome, but Britain is diverse in its way. But American culture is profoundly pluralistic. Just look at the African-American importance in that culture against great odds. This intensely creative musical culture was able to come out on top. And the immigrants that contributed to vaudeville, the immigrants that contributed to American comedy, the Jewish contribution to comedy, the sort of remarkable ability of this polyglot nation to absorb other people, to make something of their culture with many, many faults along the way. Any undergraduate can list off all the occasions of racist and prejudice in American culture. That's what we teach nowadays. But if you flip it over, you see an extraordinary achievement of kind of melding and blending and mixing up things that might have been kept separate in a more traditional society. That exports very well. It always has, and it still does. And there really isn't much like it anywhere else.
Give an example.
I'll tell you something that exports well. One thing that I really cannot find fault with, that I think is a positive export, that somehow embodies a whole bunch of American values all in one little bundle, is the huge, huge success of American Idol-type TV shows around the world. Mm. Now, don't tell me it comes out of Britain and it was called Pop Idol. I know that. But the idea, original idea, is American because it comes out of Ted Mack's Amateur Hour and the old Star Search. And, you know, it comes out of American entertainment. And it's adapted in other parts of the world. The Arab media, which go out from the Gulf region to 22 different countries, have produced a couple of these shows. One is called Star Academy and the other is called Superstar. But in just about every country of the world, there's some kind of version of American Idol. What the show does is it conveys a sense that anybody can try out. Hmm. These are societies where you don't get a job unless your uncle knows somebody, you know? But it tells young people, it's a level playing field. Come and try out. If you've got any stuff, we'll start advancing you. The political scientist Marwan Crady has a great description of it. He says it creates a kind of level playing field and a competitive environment for young people whose societies are not like that at all. Their societies are very hierarchical. There's no open competition. It's not a meritocracy. You don't get there on your own steam. Mm. It's who you're born to and who you know. And it's the opposite of that. And young people are crazy about these shows. And it's very individual. It's sort of devoted to individual expression. And there's a combination of critique from the judges. You know, every country has its Simon Cowell, you know, who gives a harsh critique. But also the popular, you know, the role of the popular vote. In countries that have no vote, you know, or don't have democratic elections, young people are SMS messaging to vote for their favorite American Idol type performers. This is a phenomenon in the world. And it's my impression is that it's seen as sort of Anglo-American. You know, it's seen as coming from that part of the globe. And I think it casts a very positive light back on its origin.
This is the good news. Sum up the bad.
Well, I've sounded negative notes here about violence and about, you know, abuses of freedom and libertinism and crime and all this stuff. What I heard from a lot of people was every society has got abuses of all kinds. There's no society in the world where these things are not going on. America and open societies like America, it's very appealing to a lot of people that we can talk about it, you know, that we can bring it out. And another format that's very popular in television around the world is the talk show, you know. And as you know, the talk show ranges from Jerry Springer on one end, which is just totally sensationalistic most of the time, to a talk show where people really try to deal with difficult things that maybe are hard to talk about. That ability to talk about things is admired by some people and deplored by some people. Some people say, this is private matter. We don't like to see this on television. You get a very negative reaction in a lot of places. But we are very open about a lot of these things that we do. In the long run, I think in the past, in our history, people have ended up admiring that about the United States. Because as I say, this stuff happens everywhere. At least in the United States, you can talk about it. You can bring it out into the open. You don't have to hide it or deny it. If you ask me, is there a role for some kind of conscious effort to project a better image of the United States culturally? Probably in some kind of public-private. What would be its focus? I would say to get out there some of the classic American popular culture. Because it still has a huge audience appeal. And, you know, as long as it's not too creaky and old-fashioned, you know. But there's a lot of very hip stuff that people just don't know anything about. A lot of the stuff that gets celebrated on American Masters on PBS, you know. People don't think America has a sophisticated high culture. And I can quote you statistics to that effect. People do not think we have any culture except the current stuff that's on the charts. And I think that, and this is true, increasingly true in Europe, where people used to have a memory of it, and that's starting to fade.
Martha, I love the music you love, but the idea of exporting the best of our past sounds worse than Ken Burns or Wynton Marsalis as a kind of preservation hall of yesterday's beat.
Oh, I totally disagree. What's wrong with transmitting something of the past? Most societies around the world are intensely tradition-minded and revere the past. They think we're very peculiar because we don't have very much regard for the past. We just think about the future and, you know, what we're going to do next, and there's a lot of truth to that. There's absolutely nothing wrong with treasuring and valuing your cultural heritage and sharing it with other people. Now, this isn't something the commercial marketplace is going to do necessarily, although I am a big fan of Turner Classic Movies. But it's something that the private sector and the nonprofit sector could do a lot there. And I will not apologize for projecting some of the classic parts of American culture. I will not apologize for that. I think we should do it, and I think people would like it.
Martha Bayliss, it's a pleasure to hear you on American Culture, on this exceptional nation, to hear you on Open Source. Thank you so much.
Oh, it was a pleasure to talk with you, as always, Chris.
Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation. Post your own two bits about the exceptional culture we Americans send abroad, for better and worse, at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining us.